Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover Psalms chapter 48, which I will entitle Zion, the City of Our God. The heading of this psalm says this, a song of the sons of Korah. Well, who were the sons of Korah? They were a choir of Levites that King David had appointed to serve in the temple worship. They were descendants, sons means descendants of, they were descendants of the famous Korah who instigated Korah's rebellion, that famous rebellion described in number 16, the results of which had the earth opening up and Korah and his co-conspirators falling into the cracks. But the descendants were not held to blame for what their ancestors had done, and so now they are serving in the temple as musicians. They probably sang this song. Now, all the Psalms since the beginning of Book 2 of the Psalms, there's five books in the Psalms. Book 1 was mainly Davidic Psalms, and now starting in Psalms 42, the Psalms have all been of the sons of Korah from 42 up to here to 48. Either by statement in the heading or by reasonable inference, we know that. So let's start now in Psalms 48, 1 through 3. Now, verses 1 and 2 were made into a great song that I used to sing all the time with my charismatic friends in the charismatic movement. In the King James, I can sing it now. I can recite verses 1 through 2 in the King James because of that song. I'm not going to sing it now. I don't want to mar your listening experience, but I really like this psalm because of that. Verse 1, great is the Lord and greatly to be praised in the city of our God. That city, of course, is Jerusalem. In apposition with city of our God is his holy mountain, which is Jerusalem. Verse 2, beautiful in elevation, the joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion in the far north, the city of the great king, God in her palaces. That doesn't mean God is a she, it means in Jerusalem's palaces. God in Jerusalem's palaces has made himself known as a stronghold. Now in verse 1, as I said, Jerusalem is called his holy mountain. Why holy? It's because the temple was on this Mount Zion, and the worship of God was in the temple. Now, it could be the tabernacle, depending on when the psalm was written. We don't know, but tabernacle or temple is the same idea. God lives in there. And since the tabernacle or the temple lived in Jerusalem, God's living in Jerusalem. Therefore, where he lives is holy. And since Jerusalem is on a mountain, that mountain is holy also. So that's why it's called a holy mountain. Now, let's look at some geography here. The temple was on Mount Moriah. Mount Moriah, as Adam Clark says, is one of the hills of which Mount Zion is composed. Mount Moriah was to the north and a little bit to the west of the whole area known as Zion. Zion is that little California-shaped promontory of land that juts down from Mount Moriah, juts down between the two valleys, the Tarpeian Valley and the Kidron Valley. Kidron Valley on the east, Tarpeian Valley on the west. That's Mount Zion proper, but then Mount Moriah can be included in Mount Zion. In fact, many people just include the whole city as Mount Zion. Sometimes in the scriptures you can see the whole city of Jerusalem referred to as Mount Zion. Sometimes even the whole land of Israel. So it was a sort of a loose term geographically, but it always symbolized something. It always symbolized the people of God, where God lives with his people. Now, I'm assuming in verse 1 that Holy Mountain refers to Mount Zion. How can I assume that? Because in verse 2, the psalmist says, Mount Zion in the far north. He refers to Mount Zion in the far north. So, using context, we know that Holy Mountain means Mount Zion. And as I said, Mount Zion is a symbol of the people of God in the Old Testament and also the New Testament, Hebrews 12:22. But you, Christians, have come to Mount Zion. Christians is not in the text, but the context tells us it's Christians, of course. The author of Hebrews is writing to Christians, and he says, but you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God. So Mount Zion is Jerusalem. This is the new Jerusalem. The author of Hebrews calls it the heavenly Jerusalem. You have come to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. Well, heaven means a Jerusalem which comes from above, right? The Jerusalem above. Well, think about Revelation, the new Jerusalem coming down out of heaven in two places in Revelation. We see the church referred to as the new Jerusalem, and Hebrews 12:22 ties the heavenly Jerusalem, the Jerusalem from above, with Mount Zion. So this symbolism is quite easy, and we need to remember anytime you see Mount Zion in the Old Testament, immediately apply it to the church in the New Testament. That is a type that will keep on giving. That's not controversial. That's not hard to interpret. Now, one remark about Mount Zion. I spent a long, long time trying to straighten out in my mind exactly where Mount Zion was. And the reason for that problem is because the word is used ambiguously all the time, referring to different geographical areas. And to make it even more complicated, when the medieval crusaders from the west of Europe came into Jerusalem, they called the southwest of the city Zion. They got confused somehow, as tourists do. And so then for years, they were referring to the southwest part of Jerusalem as Zion, which it wasn't. One more point. We say that God lives on Mount Zion. Well, he lived on the temple when Solomon built the temple. But before Solomon did that, he built the temple on Mount Moriah, Solomon did. But before he did that, David had built a tabernacle on Mount Zion proper, south of Mount Moriah, on the precise hill of Mount Zion, to handle the newly arrived Ark of the Covenant. The old tabernacle was at Gibeon, northwest of Jerusalem, and then the ark was brought by David into the city of Jerusalem from Kiriath Jearim, and David built a tabernacle to hold it. He didn't bring the tabernacle from Gibeon, and I don't know why he didn't do that. Tabernacle in Gibeon we can call Moses' tabernacle. The newly built tabernacle that David built is the Davidic tabernacle, but whatever's being referred to, a tabernacle or the temple, is being referred to as the place where God lives with his people, and that's what we should take out of this and not get lost in the weeds. Now, in verse 2, the psalmist says that Zion, Jerusalem, is beautiful in elevation. This is how Gill describes Jerusalem. The city of Jerusalem, which was delightfully situated on an eminence in a wholesome air, the brook Kidron gliding by it, the waters of Siloah running through it, or at least through some parts of it, fields and gardens adjoining to it, and mountains all around it. That's nice. But if you look at pictures of Jerusalem today, it doesn't look all that pretty to me. It looks like a desert city. It is up on a hill. I just wonder whether the psalmist is really thinking about Mount Zion as being beautiful because of all of its spiritual associations. He does say in verse 2, Jerusalem is beautiful in elevation. Maybe because it's up on a hill, it looks beautiful. I really do think that John Gill got a little too effusive in his praise of the beauty of Jerusalem. He mentions the water of Siloah. That's the water of Siloam that comes from the brook Gihon on the eastern slope of Jerusalem as you leave the walls of Jerusalem and head down into the Kidron Valley. There's a fountain there called Gihon, and then there is a stream of water that runs from that fountain transversely across the eastern wall of Jerusalem, and then it cuts through the wall of Jerusalem into the southernmost tip of Jerusalem and runs into the pool of Siloam. Siloah is another word for Siloam. And that course of water was subject to attack, and so Hezekiah ran it through a tunnel, which is still there, which tour guides will show tourists, Hezekiah's tunnel. But at any rate, Jerusalem is said to be beautiful, the joy of the whole earth. Now there is a question here. Well, before we go into that, let's see how Jerusalem is beautiful. It's beautiful in elevation. The King James has it's beautiful for situation. The NIV has beautiful in its loftiness. God's Word has its beautiful peak is the joy of the whole earth. The Holman Christian Study Bible says rising splendidly is the joy of the whole earth. You will notice that most of the modern translations have the idea of height or elevation. In the translation, the King James just says its situation in general is beautiful. Now we go to the end or the middle of verse 2. Jerusalem is said by the psalmist to be the joy of the whole earth. Now, as you know, earth can be translated as land. The Hebrew word is eretz. Well, let's assume it's earth like most of the translations have it. How can Jerusalem be the joy of the whole earth when there's a couple of problems? One is the whole earth is not going to know about Jerusalem. Point number two, what about all those Arabs in the Middle East? At least today, Jerusalem's not their joy. I can make a good case, and I'm going to in just a minute, that the word should be translated as land. Jerusalem is the joy of the whole land of Israel. That makes perfect sense, but let's just assume it's earth. If so, then this would have to be prophetic, that Jerusalem, symbolic of the New Testament church, because Jerusalem is Zion, and Old Testament Zion morphs into New Testament Zion, antitypically. And so now Jerusalem is the joy of the whole earth, because the church will be the joy of the whole earth as the church spreads out like the mustard seed growing from a small seed. So, the whole earth would then refer to when the people of God include all the Gentile nations in addition to the Jews. Now, this is one more example of how the old Jerusalem symbolizes the new Jerusalem, the church. Let me give you an example of that, Isaiah 2, verses 2 through 3. Now, it will come about in the last days, and folks, last days does not mean the end of the world. It means the end of the Jewish age, almost always. Now, it will come about that in the last days, the mountain of the house of the Lord, that's Mount Zion, will be established as the chief of the mountains. So, at the end of Jerusalem, Mount Zion will be established, that's the church, prophetically, Isaiah speaking, and will be raised above the hills, and all the nations will stream to it. That's all the Gentile nations are coming into Mount Zion. And many peoples will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, Mount Zion, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us concerning his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For the law will go forth from Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. Now, folks, if that's not a prophecy of the New Testament church, there isn't one in the Old Testament. That's obviously referring to the New Testament church. And we can say this psalm is doing the same thing here when it says that Jerusalem is the joy of the whole earth. However, if we translate it as land, it makes sense. Jerusalem is the joy of all of the land of Israel, no problem. But doesn't that destroy the universal applicability of Zion? Doesn't that kill the joy of us having all the Gentiles coming into Zion, as I just said? Well, no, it doesn't, because Isaiah 2, verses 2 through 3 is an example of how all the nations will come into Jerusalem, into Zion, and it doesn't mention earth or land in that scripture anywhere. So we're not killing a doctrine here if we translate it as land. I have no problem with translating it as earth because it's true that Jerusalem will be the joy of the whole earth. Maybe the psalmist is speaking prophetically. But on the other hand, if he's speaking land, well, that makes sense too. Now let me read you what Clark says about this translation problem. Commentators have been greatly puzzled to show in what sense Zion, or the temple, could be said to be the joy of the whole earth. If we take the earth here for the habitable globe, there is no sense in which it ever was the joy of the whole earth. But if we take Eretz as signifying the whole of this land, and it has no other meaning, the assertion is plain and easy to be understood, for the temple was considered the ornament and glory of the whole land of Judea. Now, Clark has a problem with translating that as earth because of what the land means usually, but you could say that the psalmist is looking ahead prophetically to the future, and that's what he means. Of course, we all can always debate on what the psalmist meant when he wrote. Now, in verse 2, Mount Zion is said to be located in the far north, or as the King James has it, on the sides of the north, which is not very clear. What does that mean? North of what? To make this even more complicated, the NIV translates it this way, like the utmost heights of Zaphon is Mount Zion. Zaphon? Z-A-P-H-O-N. What in the world is Zaphon? The NIV marginal note there says that Zaphon can refer to a sacred mountain or the direction north. Well, that's not very helpful to me. I think the best answer to this problem of how Jerusalem is to the north is what is described by Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. The ancients believe the north to be the highest part of the earth. And Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, look at Isaiah 14:13, which I will do. Isaiah 14:13 says, but you, referring to Babylon, but you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven, I will raise my throne above the stars of God, and I will sit on the mount of assembly in the recesses of the north. That's often not noticed when you read Isaiah 14, but it's in the north. So that might be a cultural thing. Ancient Near Eastern people just thought that anything in the far north is really high and inaccessible, very high, perhaps inaccessible to physically going there, but very accessible to one's sight. You can see it from afar off. And that's the way Mount Zion is like, because it's beautiful in elevation. It's high up where you can see it. Now, in verse 3, the psalmist says that God in her palaces, the her refers to Jerusalem, of course. God is not a she. God has made known himself as a stronghold, verse 3 says. Just like the New Testament, Zion, the church, is a stronghold for believers. And unfortunately, even though the New Testament church, the new Zion, is a stronghold for believers, a lot of believers choose not to go to church because they are so individualistic that they don't need anybody else, which is dangerous nonsense. Lone Ranger Christianity. Is there anything worse? Not much. We go to Psalms 48, verses 4 through 8. The psalmist continues, for lo, the kings assembled themselves. They passed by together. They passed by Jerusalem together. They saw it. They saw Jerusalem. Then they were amazed. They were terrified. They fled in alarm. Panic seized them there. Anguish as of a woman in childbirth. With the east wind, you break the ships of Tarshish. You, meaning God, you God. Again, the psalmist switches from third person to second person all the time. So in verse 7, he says, with the wind, you, God, break the ships of Tarshish. As we have heard, so have we seen in the city of the Lord of hosts, that's Jerusalem, in the city of our God, Jerusalem, God will establish her, Jerusalem, forever. Now, which kings assembled themselves together and walked together past Jerusalem? In verse 4, it's impossible to say which. We don't know. Verse 5, they saw Jerusalem and were amazed and they were terrified. So this is to show how strong Jerusalem is, a stronghold. How strong a stronghold Jerusalem is, as was mentioned in verse 3, because it's a place of protection for the people of God. So these enemies of Jerusalem were amazed. They were terrified. They fled in alarm. Panic seized them there. Anguish as of a woman in childbirth, assuming the woman is having labor pains and crying out. Panic seized these enemies of Jerusalem. In verse 7, we now switch from the enemies of Jerusalem to what God is going to do. With the east wind, you, God, break the ships of Tarshish. Now, what are the ships of Tarshish? Well, here's three options to describe what those ships were. Option number one, the ships of Tarshish refers to the port of origin. In other words, it's ships which came from Tarshish. Now, where's Tarshish? Well, Tartessus in Spain is often mentioned by commentators. It could be Tarsus in Cilicia, where Paul was from, which is right there at the northeastern corner of the Mediterranean Sea in Asia Minor. But whether it's Tartessus in Spain or Tarsus in Cilicia, the ships are coming from the west, and then as they head east, they get hit by the east wind. Verse 7, with the east wind, you break the ships of Tarshish. And so the point is, the ships of Tarshish are deemed to be enemies, and God blasts them with east wind off the desert, the Arabian desert there between the Euphrates and the Jordan River. That's where the east wind comes from. It's hot, it's nasty, and it breaks the ships up. So Tarshish could refer to the port of origin, option number one. Option number two, Tarshish could refer to the type of cargo the ship carried. Ships of Tarshish means ships carrying copper, because there's a lot of copper in Tarshish. That's the NIV Study Bible suggestion. Third option is suggested by the NIV Study Bible. Tarshish is a type of ship, or a ship of Tarshish is a type of ship that came from Tarshish. They were large, seaworthy ships capable of long voyages, and as such, they provide a good symbol for the enemies of God. Well, whatever it is, it doesn't really matter. The point is, they're enemies of God. They're coming after Jerusalem, and God breaks them with the east wind, because he controls the wind. Verse 8, as we have heard, so have we seen in the city of the Lord of hosts. Again, that's Jerusalem. The Lord of hosts, the host is armies. God has armies. His armies are angels, angel armies. So have we seen in the city of the Lord of hosts, in the city of our God, Jerusalem. God will establish her forever. So there you have the symbol of Jerusalem. That's the old covenant symbol of the people of God. And of course, the new Jerusalem is the symbol of the new covenant people of God, in which we will be established forever. If you take the psalm typically, and prophetically, now the psalmist says in verse 8 that God will establish Jerusalem forever. The NIV says God will make her secure forever. Now, there's a problem here, because we know that Jerusalem was not established forever. Jerusalem was destroyed in 586 BC, and not to mention 70 AD, burnt to the ground. Well, this was a conditional promise. Jerusalem would be secure as long as the people trusted God. Here's what the NIV Study Bible says, quote, God's promise came with a stipulation. As long as their trust was in God, they would be safe. But if they were to rely on anything less or refuse to serve the Lord, their security would evaporate. The wars and turmoil that have stained Jerusalem's history do not disprove God's promise of security. They prove the people's unfaithfulness, which is a great way to put it. And besides, all you have to do is look at the curses in Deuteronomy 28, verses 15 through 68, and Leviticus 26, to show how conditional this promise was. Because God said, you don't obey me, you're going to have hemorrhoids and boils, and the sky's going to turn to brass, your enemies are going to eat you up, pestilence, famine. I mean, he told them that, so the psalmist knew that. What he means is, assuming that we Israelites maintain our loyalty to Yahweh, we will be established forever. Now, how long is forever? Again, that word is ambiguous. It can either mean for a long, long time, or it can mean to all eternity. world without end, with no gaps in time, and with no cessation at the end. Well, if the psalmist is referring to Jerusalem being established forever and ever and ever, that can't be true, because I just said that Jerusalem went down a couple of times, 586 BC, 70 AD. So how can we solve that problem? Well, forever can mean for a long time. So God will establish Jerusalem for a long, long time, which of course did happen. If the psalm was written somewhere around the Psalm of David, and we don't know when it was written, that would be roughly 400 years or so. So that's a long time. Or you could take the psalm prophetically, as many people do, and say that it's the new Jerusalem that the psalmist is talking about, and that will be established forever in the sense of world without end, all the way to the end of time with no gaps, on and on and on and on, never stopping. In that case, the reference would be to the church. Here's what Adam Clark says. This must refer to the true temple, the Christian church, of which the Jewish church, and that's a bad way of putting it because the Jewish church was never called a church. The Jews were called a nation, the people of God. So let me adapt Clark's quotation here. Quote, this must refer to the true temple, the Christian church, of which Mount Zion was a type. The type perished, Jerusalem perished, but the antitype remained. That's the Christian church, and will remain till time shall be no more. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says, this present experience assures of that perpetual care which God extends to his church, present experience of Jerusalem. So again, there's so many types in Psalms. You got David being a type of the Messiah, Jerusalem being a type of the new Jerusalem, the church. And so you can just go straight to the type and say, yeah, God will establish her forever. But I prefer to think that it was only later, with further revelation of the Holy Spirit, that these types were understood. At the time of the writing of the psalm, the types were not understood, and so what the psalmist meant here is that Jerusalem was going to be established for a long, long time. Forever doesn't give you that flavor of a long, long time. It's a translation problem. We go down to Psalms 48, verses 9 through 11. The psalmist continues, we have thought on your loving kindness, O God, in the midst of your temple. As is your name, O God, so is your praise to the ends of the earth. Your right hand is full of righteousness. Let Mount Zion be glad. Let the daughters of Judah rejoice because of your judgments. Verse 9, psalmist says, we have thought on your loving kindness. The NIV says, we meditate on your loving kindness, which I think is a better translation. O God, in the midst of your temple, well, if that's Solomon's temple, that would be the temple of Jerusalem, Solomon's temple, but we can't say that necessarily because sometimes temple is put for tabernacle. A temple is a place where God lives. A tabernacle is the place, a tent is a place where God lives also. But the point is not which structure is meant, but the point is that God lives there with his people, with his people. And so the people are in the midst of God's house with him, meditating on his loving kindness. And again, the Old Testament is full of the loving kindness of God. God is not just some mean old ogre up in the sky passing out judgment on everybody and all sinful peoples. He does that if you sin. Yeah, he'll take you out. But his main point is the loving kindness he shows to his people. Verse 10, as is your name, O God, so is your praise to the ends of the earth. Now, here's a problem. When this psalm was written, how had God's name and praise reached the ends of the earth? Well, here's some options to answer that question. Option number one, through creation. This is the NIV Study Bible suggestion and John Gill's suggestion. Romans 1, 19 through 20, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. Talking about unsaved people. God is evident to these unsaved people, for since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. In other words, your praise to the ends of the earth. You look outside, the heavens declare God's glory. The heavens are God's handiwork, declaring God's glory. The pagans look at it, and the praise of God goes all over the world, all over the physical earth. That makes sense to me. The NIV Study Bible has another option, which I think is not very good. Here's a quote from the NIV Study Bible. Quote, some suggest that the religious tendencies in all cultures throughout the history of humankind, though at times distorted, have shown that God's reality has indeed touched the ends of the earth. At times distorted? That's an understatement. Human beings have distorted God so much it's beyond belief at times. How about 99.999% of the time? They don't praise the true God at the ends of the earth because the knowledge of God is written in their hearts. No, they don't do that. They don't praise God through Buddha or through Islam. I think that is pathetic, in my humble opinion, to say that that's how God's praise goes to the ends of the earth, because there's religions all over the world that believe in God. No, they don't believe in the true God. John Gill suggests option number 3. So is your praise to the ends of the earth? Gill simply refers that to the fulfillment in the New Jerusalem, the New Church, the New Covenant Church. Mel Gill doesn't like types. He shrinks the types to nothingness, and he goes straight to the antitype. I'll say once again, I don't think the psalmist here was shrinking the type to where he thought that God's praise was not going to go to the ends of the earth until it was fulfilled in the far-off future. I don't think so. Now, here's another solution. This is the solution of yours truly. Translate earth as land, Eretz. So is your praise to the ends of the land. Well, that's true in the time of the psalmist. At that time, God's name and praise actually did reach to the ends of Israel. And to back me up on that, if you look at the next verse, verse 11, we see terms of the land of Israel being used. Let Mount Zion be glad. Let the daughters of Judah, that's Jerusalem. Let the daughters of Judah rejoice. That's an example of Jews praising. And then back in verse 10, one verse previous, so is your praise to the ends of the land, because the daughters of Judah, the population of Judah, is praising God. I think that's the best way to go there, to handle that little problem of how is God's praise sent to the ends of the earth. And once again, however you interpret the psalm, we do know that God's praise will go to the ends of the earth. The church right now is spread all over the globe. Verse 10, the psalmist says that your right hand, referring to God's right hand, is full of righteousness. The right hand, of course, symbolizes power, because it's the strong hand, as it is with most people. And so God's hand is usually described as a right hand because it's a hand of power. We go now to verses 12 through 14 of Psalms 48, and we'll be finished with this audio. Walk about Zion and go around her. Count her towers. Now, the psalmist is just talking to whoever's listening, an unnamed addressee. Walk about Zion and go around her. Count her towers. Consider her ramparts. Go through her palaces, that you may tell it to the next generation. Again, the psalmist is using the physical city of Zion, the city of Jerusalem, as a symbol of a stronghold, a place that God dwells, and that we dwell with him in safety and security. Verse 14, for such is God, our God, forever and ever. He will guide us until death. Verse 12, the psalmist says, walk about Zion, go around her, count her towers. And verse 13, consider her ramparts. Ramparts has always bothered me. I can't ever picture it. I read all types of history, military history, and you see about ramparts. Well, I looked up the term in the American Heritage Dictionary, and a part of one definition said this, an elevation or mound of earth round a place capable of resisting cannon shot. I looked up ramparts on Google Images, and most of the images pulled up showed a stone wall around a castle, and that stone wall was crenellated, had little rectangular gaps in it so that the defenders could put cannons through the crenellations. Of course, that wouldn't be true in the time of Israel, but that's just what the pictures show. Mostly a wall, a stone wall. And spaced along the stone walls, you'd see towers. Well, that sort of fits here. Go around Zion, walk around on the wall, counter towers, because the towers would be at spaced out intervals along that wall. Consider her ramparts. Look how strong the walls are. Nobody's going to get through those walls. Again, the whole purpose is strength. The imagery is strength, strength, strength. God is strong enough to protect his people. Go through her palaces. That's where people are going to be living, not only in security, but in somewhat sort of luxury. And then you talk about Zion so that you may tell it to the next generation. Let me take a little rabbit trail here. I see so many Christians today talking about Jerusalem, 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 and they're talking about that city over there in the Middle East. Now, I've been there. It's a beautiful city. I think it's wonderful. But Christians who do this, in my opinion, tend to miss the forest looking at the trees. The point of Jerusalem is it's a symbol of where God lives and where people live with him. Believers in God live with him. That's not true of present-day Jerusalem. It's a secular city. Now, there are religious Jews in Jerusalem, but that's not the true religion, is it? That's not the religion of Jesus Christ. So why are Christians focusing on the stones of Jerusalem instead of what Jerusalem symbolizes, the New Jerusalem, the church? Verse 14, the psalmist says, for such is God, our God, forever and ever. He will guide us until death. Well, until death defines forever and ever. Again, forever and ever is ambiguous. It can mean for a long time. It can be to the end of a lifetime, or it can be to the end of eternity. When there is no end to eternity, world without end, and so forth. Well, here, The psalmist is apparently talking individually about people who will die, and God will be our God until that happens, forever and ever. Forever in the Old Testament sometimes does mean until the end of someone's life. I don't have sites in front of me, but as we go through, I've mentioned it over and over again. That's important because sometimes when you see this forever and ever, a lot of times annihilationist, ultimate reconciliation people will say, see there, that doesn't mean we're going to live with God forever and ever. It doesn't mean we're going to have an afterlife. It just means we're going to live until we die. Well, they are right that sometimes the phrase forever and ever can mean that, but they are wrong because there's so many other verses that show that we're going to live with God eternally. We're not going to sleep. We're not going to have slow sleep, and we're not going to be annihilated. Now, John Gill uses other translations here, using other manuscripts. He says that the phrase, he will guide us until death, should be translated, he will guide us in death, or he will guide us above death. If that were true, if that were the correct translation, then that would mean that forever would take us beyond the point of death into eternity, and so then God will be guiding us in heaven as well as down here on earth. But I don't think that Gill can be relied on there. I don't know what manuscripts. It doesn't matter. The psalmist meant that God will guide the believer in him until the day that the believer dies. And that is a positive way to end a psalm. Almost all the psalms have ended very positively and with much encouragement. So we are now finished with Psalms 48. So we are now prepared in our next audio to go to Psalms 49, which I will entitle, Why Should I Fear in Times of Trouble? Great title for a psalm in these days of trouble here in the United States of America. I hope to see you in that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.